Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, June 11th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio in New York. Today, we're going to be hearing from Mark McGwire, who, of course, is the subject of the upcoming 30 for 30 documentary on ESPN this coming Sunday night. Kylie McDaniel will join us to talk about the first round of the Major League Baseball draft, which had some twists and turns and may set the table for the next battlefield in the widening war between the union and Major League Baseball. Kylie will explain all that coming up. Some news and notes. Claudel Washington, two-time All-Star outfielder who played 17 seasons in the majors after being called up as a teenager by the Oakland Athletics, passed away. He was 65. Claudel played with seven teams in his career, finishing with 1,884 hits, 164 home runs, and 312 stolen bases. He made the All-Star team in 1975 with the A's and in 1984 with the Atlanta Braves during his long career. I never met him, but folks who I talked to who did know him talked about what a good guy he was. The Boston Red Sox on Wednesday responded to recent comments by former Major League outfielder Torrey Hunter. It was actually Torrey's interview in Golic and Wingo regarding racial abuse at Fenway Park. The Red Sox saying that Torrey experiences were real and they vowed to continue to improve as an organization in that area. The Minnesota Twins are owned by the Pollard family announced Wednesday that they are committing $25 million to racial justice through their family foundation. The first round of the Major League Baseball draft was held last night. Here's how the first pick went.
With the first pick of the 2020 MLB draft, the Detroit Tigers select Spencer Torkelson, a third baseman from Arizona State University.
Austin Martin, who was projected on a lot of boards to be picked at number two, fell to number five to the Blue Jays. Again, Kylie will explain why that happened. There continues to be no collaboration, no cooperation in the labor talks. Commissioner Rob Manfred told our Carl Ravitch that there will be baseball this year.
How will you feel if and when this time comes? We're playing 48 games, boys, and let's get ready to go. How will you feel if that's the end result of this?
I'll be disappointed that we're unable to reach an agreement that allows us to play more games. But you know what? I think at the end of the day, the most important thing, and I'm not buying into your number of 48, the most important thing is that we play Major League Baseball in 2020, and I can tell you unequivocally, we are going to play Major League Baseball this year.
And lastly, the percent of a chance we're playing Major League Baseball this year?
100%.
So before we get to Kylie, some programming notes. The Major League Baseball draft coverage continues tonight, rounds 2 through 5. That will air from 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern on ESPN2. The event will also stream live versus the or on the ESPN app. Don't forget this Sunday, June 14th at 9 p.m. Is ESPN's latest 30 for 30 Long Gone Summer. After the airing of Long Gone Summer, you can check out Jalen Jacoby's The After Show podcast with Long Gone Summer director A.J. Schnock. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. And a reminder that all 30 for 30 films are available on ESPN Plus immediately after airing. Kylie McDaniel covers baseball for ESPN. And Kylie, last night, I know following it from afar, a big shakeup right away in the draft. You know, tell us about how that went down and what you understand after Torkelson got taken.
So that was the big sort of question the days leading up to the draft is, what is Mike Elias, the GM of the Orioles, who used to be with Houston? He was there when they took Carlos Correa 1-1, which was an underslot option, ended up obviously being the right pick. And so the thought was, there's a chance he might do this again. Austin Martin is seen as the consensus best player, the second baseman from Vanderbilt, to go number two, but he may go under slot with either Nick Gonzalez, second baseman at New Mexico State, or Heston Kerstad, a right fielder at Arkansas. Gonzalez was seen as almost a coin flip leading into the draft. I was texting with Passan, all kinds of other people trying to figure out what was going to happen. Nobody was tipping their hand. And Kerstad was seen as the third most likely option. So call it, I would say my expectation was 55% Martin, 30% Gonzalez, 15% Kerstad, and they went Kerstad. And I had him ninth in my rankings. It's not like he doesn't deserve to go up here, but to justify that versus the other six or seven guys they could have taken at the further below slot than Martin would have demanded, they need a big cut there. I don't know what the number is yet. And I think the reason they were doing that is hoping that the mystery man of the draft, Pennsylvania prep writing Nick Bitsko, would make it all the way to 30. The Tampa Bay jumped up and took him at 24. So if that was the plan, they got a little extra money left over to spend on day two.
All right. Why did Martin continue to slide? Because he wound up not being picked until number five by the Blue Jays.
So this is the other sort of mystery. I had heard that there were some teams that didn't get a lot of high level, call him national cross checker, director, special assistant type looks on Martin last year when he was just the consensus, like sixes and sevens all over the board. Everybody loved this guy. This spring, he was a little banged up. He had tentative throws from third base, looked like he had lost a step defensively to the point where he may not be able to play center field, which is versatility was one of his strengths. And he still wasn't necessarily lifting the ball at the plate, which was sort of the other big issue that scouts wanted to see solved. And there was some suspicion that there was an issue at him playing shortstop because a true freshman was playing there instead of he was rumored to be playing there for Vanderbilt. So teams that got the majority of their decision maker looks on Martin, if they were this spring, tended to have him lower than other teams. He's also advised by Scott Boras. And while you're not incentivized up top to have big bonus demands because the slots go down dramatically by each pick. So if you just slide two picks, you pretty much can't get the same kind of slot you were going to get at the two picks earlier. I think that had something to do with it.
What did you think about that? The decisions at 2, 3, and 4 to not pick him?
So at 2, as I said, I would have picked a different player than Kerstad. I think he's a little bit risky given some of the swing and miss, even though he has performed well in terms of, you know, actual production. At 3 with Meyer, I can't fault that. He's in that top tier of player. He would go straight onto a top 100. He can go to the big leagues and pitch in the bullpen immediately. The Marlins are trying to turn on their franchise, and most of their top of their system is in AAA or in the big leagues. So that makes total sense to me. I have no problem with that. We had heard that Kansas City was hoping that one of those top three prospects, Martin, Torkelson, or Lacy, would slide out of the top three, and Lacy was the one they wanted. Lacy was the one they got. So you can't fault them for passing because it sounds like Lacy was maybe the second highest guy on their board. And then Toronto was actually one of the teams I had heard got a lot of bad looks on Martin early in the spring, and they might pass on him if he got there. It sounds like they're going to go over slot to get him, and at some point you just have to take the best bat in the draft. And, you know, just kind of ride with it and see what happens. And if he plays second base, you got Vlad Jr. at first or third. You got Bichette at shortstop. Like, that's got the making of a team that can make the playoffs in the AL East.
Yeah, Kyle, it was funny. The other day I had Tim Corbin, the Vanderbilt coach, on, and he was talking about Austin Martin and gave us a scouting report on him. And I asked him for a comp, and he mentioned Anthony Rendon. And as that played out last night, I was kind of chuckling to myself. And you know this better than I do, but I thought, you know what? Austin Martin sliding to 5 reminds me of Rendon sliding to 6, where going into that draft, there's some questions about, you know, an injury that he'd had, a bad ankle injury, I think it was, some questions about position. And then, as we sit here today, you know, he just got a $245 million contract. And I think if you were to poll players, a lot of them would think of him as being the best pure hitter in baseball. Were those situations at all similar?
Yeah, no, I didn't make that direct comp. I said it was sort of Zobristy in that it's multi-positional without tons of power, but he could turn into a Justin Turner type if he makes some of the swing adjustments that scouts want. But it actually, Rendon is another good one because Rendon was seen as long track record of hitting, not impact power, but a chance to grow into it, and had some nagging injuries where Rendon, I think, missed a little more time, whereas Martin would sort of play through some nagging injuries, and I think it affected some of his play on the field, like I mentioned with the tentative throws. So yeah, there are a lot of similarities, and I was talking to a scouting director that's picking up in the top 5. I mean, not one of the ones that picked Martin, but he said, like, at some point, this is before the draft, he said, at some point, what guy has been projected as the best bat in the draft that hasn't been a very good bat, and how many guys have a very good bat and don't become useful big leaguers? Like, that's just the safest pick in the draft, even if your most recent looks were not the best.
All right. Considering what happened yesterday, what was the biggest head scratcher pick for you?
So the big one that threw everybody for a loop was Northern California high school second baseman shortstop, Nick York going to the Red Sox at number 17. I had him 69th on my rankings. I think I actually had him higher than all the other sort of big public rankings. I still didn't have him in my two-round mock draft leading into the draft, in part because I was told he was going to be a tough sign in the second round, and now it seems obvious that it's because he was getting a lot of nibbles in the first round. That's why he would have been tough to sign in the second round. So I just thought that meant he wanted to go to school and he was going to be a tough sign, and the interest for him would, you know, show up anywhere from 40 to 60. And if nobody pulled the trigger, then he'd go to school. Obviously, it turned out that there was interest higher. So in the moment, obviously, nobody in like the, you know, the first 30 picks went, you know, well outside. I think the lowest guy I had ranked other than York was, I had a guy going 42nd on my rankings, went in the top 30, but it was a guy that I thought was going to go in the top 30 in Jordan Walker. So York, the issue here is the Red Sox are missing a pick, because of the sign stealing scandal. And part of what a lot of teams are doing, I think Baltimore is one of them, is if you have a group of players you're considering and one of them is much cheaper, take the one that is much cheaper. It'll save you some money for later. The problem is in a normal draft, you've got 15, 20, 30 other picks to spend that money. And this draft, you got a handful of picks. So it's like you're playing, you're putting a puzzle together and you don't have 4 hours to put the puzzle together. You got like 1 hour. So you got to do some like speed puzzle solving. And so if it comes down to your last pick, you've got 600K. And the two options want either 800K or 400K. You're just going to leave money on the table. Like there's not another way to solve that, where when there's like almost an unlimited amount of rounds, you can just keep taking guys until the money's gone. So the thought is if you're taking a middle infielder that's a bat first guy, that's the profile of Jeter Downs, the main prospect in the Mookie Betts trade and the Red Sox top prospect. If you look at what Chaim Bloom was involved in the draft with Tampa until he came over to Boston, they took a lot of middle infielders that people thought were second basemen. They're actually better at shortstop, both because of, you know, metrics and coaching and things like that. And they took a lot of bat first guys without a lot of impact power, and a lot of them have gotten better. So it both fits who they've traded for, who they have in their system, the sorts of players that tend to be underrated, who Chaim Bloom has taken at other places. It also spreads out the risk and gives them an opportunity to have the hammer financially later in the draft. So this one, I don't think you can pass judgment on until you see who they take today.
What was your favorite pick of the day?
I mean, I think Martin's the second best player. I published before the draft that I have Torkelson as the 19th prospect on my top 100 for when the day he signs and enters the system. I have Martin at 36. So I think there's some separation there, but those two guys could flip in less than a year if in a normal year where they're playing in the minor leagues. So I have those guys relatively close and they shouldn't be going four picks apart. So as much as I'd like to say it's somewhere else, some guy that went 35th that I thought should have gone 25th, like just take the best bat in the draft. And, you know, for whatever reason, some teams didn't do that.
And Kylie's rankings from the draft yesterday, Kylie, just before we get started taping, you finished writing those. Those should be posted on ESPN.com very shortly.
Yeah, I would guess by noon Eastern today on Thursday, and then at 5 o'clock we get going with the day two broadcast.
And I retweeted a story that from yours that posted early this morning, which is who are the best players still left on the board? Who's the number one player still left on the board? Do you think it's going to be grabbed early?
So the two guys that are at the top of the board would be Clayton Beter, a righty out of Texas Tech, and Dylan Dingler, a catcher out of Ohio State. I've heard some whispers that the reason Dingler slipped, there's no reason on talent that he should still be on the board, as there were some medical things that were sort of disclosed late that teams are working through. I would expect him to either go quickly. I don't know if there's a possibility if his number isn't met and he goes back to school. But, I mean, the tools are essentially the same as Joey Bart, who went second overall 2 years ago and is one of the top prospects in the game. So there's a little less, you know, level of competition, performance, polish, things like that, but it's not that far away. So he should have gone already. I think he will go quickly. Beter had Tommy John surgery, came back in the fall, was getting some attention for running his fastball up to 98-99. This spring he did that. He was a little better at throwing strikes and has maybe the single best pitch in the entire draft, an 80 grade curveball with an insane over 3000 RPM, pitch. And the issue is it's post Tommy John. It's not a long track record of doing anything, not a long track record of throwing strikes. And if the season had one more month, every team would have enough looks to take him. A lot of teams didn't even get a decision maker in to see him. So you're doing it off of video and TrackMan. And I think that's the main reason why he wasn't taken yet.
So those guys who were taken in the draft yesterday, as you know, that until they're added to the 40-man rosters, they will not be members of the Players Association. But for a lot of them, they have agents who, of course, are embroiled in the current fight going on between the two sides. You know, you mentioned the other day the possibility of teams taking a very much of an approach of take it or leave it with their offers and cutting their offers, you know, 20% below slot. Do you think it's possible that the draft and some of the signings will become another battlefield in part of this larger war between the two sides?
Yeah, because the thing that I had heard from a lot of agents leading into the draft was, I haven't gotten a call on my first round prospect in 3 days. I think I know who likes him. We've had plenty of conversations. I have an idea of where he goes. The fact that they aren't calling tells me not that they're suddenly not interested, because there's no reason for that. It's that they're going to call me 5 minutes before the pick, offer me way below slot, give me no time to shop it around, and hope they can sort of pressure me into taking a number. And that doesn't even include that, you know, maybe if you don't agree to a number when you're picked, you then get like even more severely lowballed, and then sort of held up. You want to be the first or second or third rounder that doesn't sign. Those are the picks that have compensation tied to them. So in the fourth and fifth round, I wouldn't expect that sort of thing. But the first through third rounds, I think so. And the other part of this is, I was told there's all kinds of teams looking for deals in the top 10. As I was sitting there on the set 5 minutes before the draft was going to start, trying to finish my mock draft, I'm asking all the teams in the top 10, you know, GMs, agents, everybody. And they're all like, we have no idea. Like 2 and 3 and 4, they're like, we don't know yet. Because they were all shopping around numbers. And so when you see guys like Kerstad and Meyer go in the top 5, that tells me they're doing severe cuts there. You would like to think they're doing severe cuts so that they can spend the money later. It could be a severe cut because they don't have their full bonus pool and they'd rather cut one pick than have to cut all of them. So I think those unusual names, the Nick Yorks, guys like that, a lot of those are strategic moves that would have happened in any draft, but I can't help but think that there's not going to be overslot moves to match all of those underslot moves.
Wow. Just before the start of the draft last night, Rob Manfred, as you know, did an interview with Carl Ravitch, and he left open the possibility that if there's not an agreement between the two sides, he's going to ram through some sort of season, you know, without collaboration from the players. During the course of the night, you had tweets from Max Scherzer, Chris Iannetta, who are members of the executive committee, basically firing at owners. You saw it from Jack Flaherty, the Cardinals last night. How much did, as you're going through that last night, how much did it, the state of the labor negotiation sort of loom over this event?
I mean, it was refreshing in a way, not what happened before the draft, but during the draft, when you're just like waiting for a quiet moment for Passan to jump in and be like, hey, remember guys, we don't have an agreement, like just to be the, you know, the wet blanket on all this, is you see these kids going nuts and, you know, jumping out of their seats and, you know, giving the dog a hug and, you know, all that kind of thing. I like to think that I am sometimes can be the cynical guy and try to be objective and, you know, have some robot qualities or whatnot. I can't not smile and want to narrate like, oh, look, that guy's got a nice pocket square. Look at that guy's hat. And look at the mom giving a big hug. And everybody's so like, you can't not smile at that. And I don't know if that was a calculated move by Manfred to give the, you know, kind of bad guy speech before the draft and then have all of this, you know, jubilation and celebration sort of obscured a bit. I mean, I guess it's positive that he's saying they're absolutely going to play. I'd rather see them play. I think looking back 10 years on this, people are going to say, I'm glad we played, you know, provided there's not some huge outbreak or something. But sort of having this, you know, celebrational moment at the draft and having this still hanging over it is just like a failure on all parts. And it's hard to look at it any way other than that once the sort of, you know, fog of how fun was that, you know, the first night of the draft kind of get away from it.
All right, coverage picks up again, 5 o'clock Eastern on ESPN2 of the remaining rounds of draft. Kylie, thanks for doing this, and I hope you get some sleep over the weekend.
Thanks, man. I went and got a carton of cold brew from the Target, and after 2 mornings, I drank the whole thing. This is not a great sign.
Thank you. 4 years ago, Mark McGwire was interviewed by Dari Noka, Mel Kiper for ESPN Radio, but that interview never aired. It's heard for the first time right here. Give a listen.
Time now to bring in the man who did set the record. That 1998 season, Mark McGwire, the 70 home runs at the time was the single season record, since passed. But what an unbelievable battle it was individually, Mark, between you and Sammy Sosa. Looking right back on it now, some 18 years, what wow. What stands out the most?
Jeez, craziness. don't forget Ken Griffey Jr. finished with 56. Yeah. And it was Ken Griffey and I that was battling up until the middle of the season. And then Sammy came pretty much out of nowhere and just started hitting a bunch of home runs and caught me. And next thing you know, he and I were in a battle all the way to the end.
Mark, you came into September with, I believe, 55 home runs. You needed seven to break Roger Maris's record. How much pressure were you feeling at that point? How much of a relief, Mark? How much of a relief was it? You hit two home runs in each of your first two games against the Marlins, and did that relieve some of the pressure, or was it still as great as it ever had been?
Yeah, to this day, I don't think an individual has gone through what I've gone through in 98 season, just because it was all about just one person. It wasn't about a team, and the whole nation was watching to put pressure. Yeah, that's a lot of pressure, isn't it? But I knew I had a month left or more to break it. So I knew it was just a matter of just me just staying in my zone, doing what I know what I was doing, having my game plan. I walked well over 150 times. So it's like, it was one of those things where I knew after that first at bat, I knew if they're going to go after me early or not, and just stay in my strike zone. And, I knew if I put a good swing on a ball and I centered it, I had a pretty good chance of leaving the ballpark.
And then you're sitting there with a chance against Sammy and the Cubs in September,
right,
with a chance to get to the record, to pass the record.
Right.
Sammy's on the field. As you get into, you're at home, fortunately, as you get into that series, did you look at the opportunity any differently because it was against the Cubs, because it was against Sammy Sosa's team?
I don't think so. I mean, it just worked out that way. A lot of weird things happened that series against the Cubs. I mean, you think back on September 7th, I hit my 61st home run on my father's 61st birthday. That's pretty wild, isn't it?
Wow, yeah.
I hit number 62 in the fourth inning, the same inning that Roger Maris hit 61.
Amazing.
The ball was marked. They MLB put this mark on it where you only could see it by a certain kind of light to see what number. They marked every ball. When I came up to the plate, they brought certain balls in the through for the pitcher to pitch to pitch me with. The ball that hit over the fence, number 62, was marked number 3, Babe Ruth. So it was a very, very eerie sort of like, you sit back and think, I still get chills even thinking about that first 61 on my dad's 61st birthday. Roger Maris hit 61 on October 1st, 2 years later, October 1st, 1963, I was born.
Wow.
Really?
So yeah,
man.
It's one of those things that it's really never been talked about, and it's a thing that I got chills just thinking about it right now.
And we do too. They just hear
you know, reminiscing 18 years, going on 19 years now since it happened. But the fact is that I still remember going out on the field in the top of the fourth inning, and I remember this calmness that came over me. And it was eerie. It was almost like it was going to happen the next at bat, and it did.
You thought that?
It was one of those things. I just had that feeling. When I got to the plate, I totally forgot about that feeling. But when I was out there defensively in the top of the fourth inning, it's really hard to describe the feeling that came over my body. That night, they gave me Roger Maris's bat, and I hugged it and I kissed it, and I don't know if he was looking down on us watching. I believe he was. The whole family was there, and doing it in the same inning that he did it to break the record. I mean, that just tells you how just special that was.
I'll tell you, we got the pleasure here of talking to Mark McGuire about the chase and about 1998 and all that went into it. And Mark, Dari and I, big baseball fans, and you talk about that day and that at bat, the way you do with all those memories and everything tied into it. Take us through, Mark, that entire at bat, September 8th against the Cubs, that enabled you to break the record.
Well, I wish I can take you pitch by pitch. I always remember facing Steve Traxel, just really heavy sinker down to the zone. Just a guy that I like. I like sinker ballers. I like guys throwing the ball low. You knew you had to be patient with him. He was a type of pitcher that he wanted you to get yourself out. I faced him quite a few times prior. It was just one of those things where I got a sinker down. I hit a line drive, and I'm thinking, that's a double down the line, you know, and I'm putting my head and, you know, I'm thinking, I got to get a double out of this. Sure enough, as I look up, Dave McKay is like, had his hands way up in the air, and he sort of blocked me from trying to hit first base, and the ball goes out of the ballpark. And next thing you know, I turn around. I just said, I better go back and touch the base, you know? and then just, it was one of those things where, I mean, you watch the video and I'm hugging guys, shaking guys' hands and hugging people.
Cubs.
And I don't know what came over. I just said, oh my God, I'm just going to do this. And I remember getting home plate and just giving Scott Service this big hug. And then my son came up and the whole team came out. It was truly just unbelievable. And then again, I had to go out and play the rest of the game. You know, it's like, you know, could it just end right there? But no, I had to go play the rest of the game, and we ended up winning the ball game. And, you know, it was just, it was just one of those things where, wow, you know, this really happened because, you know, I was tabbed to break this record going back to 1987. You know, I came on a scene, you know, in 87, and I ended up hitting 49 home runs, which still is a major league and rookie record. But I had 33 home runs at the All-Star break. And that's all that everybody talked about was Mark McGwire's going to break the record someday. Mark McGwire's going to break the record. And sure enough, 1998, I did. So it was one of those things where I throughout my career, you know, I had so many ups and downs with a bunch of injuries. I contemplated on retiring at one time because of my foot injuries, and to bust through these walls that tried to take me down and to overcome that, to get to 98, was truly, truly special.
Mark McGwire, 70 home runs in that great 1998 run with us. It was cool to see, too. I mean, Sammy Sosa runs in and congratulates mm-hmm. you when it was over. What was that moment like? Do you remember what either of you said to one another?
I just think, I'm pretty sure he just said, you're the man. He used to always say, you're the man. So, you know, I don't know Sammy personally. I just, you know, I just know him playing through the game. We had a nice relationship doing the press conferences we did. We had such a great battle. You know, I go back and think about it. You know, it's like, so I got to 62. You know, he caught me. And we were tied at 62 at one time, I believe it was, or 63. And I said to myself, I mean, you know what? It's not going to be a record if I don't finish the season with the most home runs. Sammy Sosa would have the record.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So my mind went into another gear. I had to go into another gear mentally. And that's a place where I think so few athletes can ever reach. And I reached it. It's one of those things where it's so hard to describe how deep mentally you can go and how powerful your mind is when your back is, you know, put against the wall saying, wait a minute, you know, this is something so great. We all celebrated this on September 8th, 1998. But you know what? If I don't finish at the end of the season on September 27th, I wouldn't have the record. And then it was that Friday night, what was it, the 25th, I believe it was. He had tied me. I think he was in Houston. He had tied me with 66. And the next day, Saturday and Sunday, I went out and hit two home runs each game and finished with 70. And it was one of those things where you talk about just getting to that another level. And, mm-hmm. you know, when Tony La Russa goes around and gives speeches and stuff, he always brings that up, that people don't really understand, you know, how mentally tough, you know, I was, and how he and I used to have these talks about how I was getting into another gear. And to have understanding that, you know, I had to finish with that record or I wouldn't have had it. And that's something that nobody's ever really talked about.
Mark, that's the main, Dari and I were talking before we even spoke to you today. And it just, I've been thinking about the last few days leading up to talking to you and about the enormous pressure and the fact that the toughest thing to do in any sport is hit a baseball. And now you're asked not only to hit the baseball, to elevate it and hit it out of the park.
Yeah.
And you talked about the emotions and what went into this, you know, controlling your nerves, not the press, not the think, overthink things, your eating habit. Athletes are a creature of habit, Mark, and your habits had to change. You're being asked to talk before, during, after games. The world is watching. The spotlight's on every at bat of Mark McGwire. Was it ever, Mark, just totally overwhelming to you where the fun of the game was being lost in all this talk about home runs?
I can't say it. Yeah, maybe to a point it was, but you know what? When I was between the lines, nobody could get to me. Mm-hmm. Not one soul could get to me.
That was your safe zone.
That was my safe zone. And that's where I got into that other gear in my mind. And I mean, I knew my mind was strong, but I put it to a test that season. And to understand that I had to play a game before the game with a BP, you know, where people, you'd have 20,000 people come to watch my batting practice. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I still remember when John Henry owned the Miami Marlins, he got word that I wasn't going to take batting practice. I wanted to take a break. And I remember him coming down to the clubhouse and asking me personally to take batting practice.
Wow.
Because there's going to be 25,000 fans in the stands to watch me take batting practice. So to play a game before the game actually happened, you know, think about that. I mean, and you start putting these things together. To this day, I still don't think any athlete's ever gone through anything what I've gone through on a personal level, individual accomplishment ever in the history of sports. You think about all the stuff that Michael Jordan's done. It was all team. You know, and what Kobe Bryant has done. All these Hall of Fame. It's just unbelievable.
Mark, how did your family deal with all this? All this pressure on you? How were they during all this?
I think they were great. I had my son, you know, he's now 29, you know, he was a bat boy there at 10 years old. And, you know, I mean, he got to be with me a lot of the time. And, you know, I got to, you know, cherish the moment with him. And it's like, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, how many times does a father get to cherish something like that with their son? I mean, you know, now I have two more boys and I have triplet girls. Now I have five more, you know, of my family, and unfortunately I don't get to cherish those things. Like, you know, I get to maybe do something as a coach or someday a manager, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's one of those things that you never can take back, because it's anytime you can cherish something like that with somebody like my son, it was just truly special.
Mark, what was it like as we chat with Mark McGwire 3 years later? This record that you set that nobody thought could be reached, 70 home runs.
Right.
What was it like watching Barry Bonds hit 73?
Well, I mean, I've been saying, it's like, I know how tough it is. You know, he walked a lot. He didn't, you know, I mean, he was the master of the walk. You know, it didn't bother him. Like, it walked didn't bother me. It's all about patience. It's all about the belief in your swing. When you got a pitch to hit and you put the barrel on the ball, there's a really good chance that the ball is going to leave the ballpark. It's not easy to do. It's not easy to do. You're right. It's one of the hardest things to do in sports today, to hit a baseball and hit it a long ways. You know, you think about it, a round bat trying to hit a round ball and hit it squarely. It's really hard to do. But you know what? He did it, and it was truly an awesome year for him.
Something that has been developed recently that's, I think, awesome, quite honestly, is the Today's Game Era Hall of Fame ballot. And this is something that, Mark, you're on.
Mm-hmm.
10 people total. They'll vote on this in December. And it's almost like it gives people another chance, another way to get into the Hall of Fame. You haven't been able to get in there yet. This gives you a new chance. What does that mean?
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, geez. I would be totally honored. Like I've said, I'd be totally honored. Are my numbers Hall of Fame worthy? Absolutely. Absolutely. 12-time All-Star. You know, I still the lowest at-bat per ratio for home run, 10. Every 10 at-bat, you know, I was going to hit a home run. You know, I hold an all-time rookie record at 49 and 87. 583 home runs. You know, the fewest 583 home runs were the fewest at-bats and the fewest games in the history of the game.
Yeah.
Gold Glove. I mean, it's and the fact that to bring the game back from the strike of 94, that says a lot. When I still walk around, you know, the city today, and when people notice me and they say that you're the reason why I got back to baseball, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, that says a lot. So mm-hmm. for this committee, if I'm lucky enough to get voted in, it's what a great honor to be with all those great players. I mean, it's just, I'd be absolutely speechless.
It's awesome. It's awesome to see you still in the game, too. Bench coach with the San Diego Padres.
Oh, yeah.
Mark McGwire.
Thank you.
Hey, best of luck on the vote, but I can't
Thank you so much, guys.
Of course. I can't tell you how cool it's been to listen to you go back 18 years in your own mind and relive it with us. We appreciate your time so much.
Anytime. I really enjoyed it.
Here's Tim Kirchen's Daily Baseball Fix about Paul Molitor.
This date in 1999, the Brewers retired Paul Molitor's uniform number 4. In Milwaukee, they called him the Igniter. He had the 9th most hits of all time, more than Willie Mays. He hit .368 in the postseason, .418 in the World Series, and was the MVP of the 1993 World Series. He was such a good hitter, he once went to a luncheon, walked in the room and saw Ted Williams break off a conversation with Joe DiMaggio and then ran over to talk to Molitor about hitting. Molitor said, "Oh my goodness, I'm talking to Ted Williams." He said, "I didn't even know what to say." He said, "I must have sounded like a complete idiot." But he was anything but. He's one of the smartest players I've ever seen. He's one of the best base runners of all time. And he went on to manage the Twins. So in 2017, when the Twins were in Milwaukee, one of the young Twins players looked at the hanging banners at Miller Park, saw number 4, looked at Molitor and said, "Is that you?" And Molitor said very softly, "Yes, that's me."
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. First up, and this is a thought I had last night too, as my Baltimore Orioles selected 2nd overall in the draft, and I was thinking, you know, they might get a high pick again next year. Tyler Manning's,
oh, yeah.
He writes in that Tyler Manning 79. Just a random thought. Say there is a season this year, 50 games. Why not for most teams just to tank again and finish last place? Would it make sense just to grab another top first round pick for 2021? That, I mean, tanking already prevalent in Major League Baseball, but you got to think with a 50 game season, it could be even more common.
Yep. Club executives fear that. Absolutely. And I tell you what, given the fact that, you know, we're seeing these roster of pitchers expanding, don't be surprised if, you know, in a key game, suddenly one team that might be close to the bottom of the standings, maybe they'll start that Class A prospect just to see how he does for a few innings and contribute to the demise of various teams. As I talked about, and I'm going to write about this weekend, the Houston Astros syndrome is alive and well in Major League Baseball.
Debbie Grammons Brown writes in, "I know we all want baseball to happen any way we can get it, but I'm curious to know how you feel about games being played in neutral sites, especially Todd Radom. You know, he always mentions giving his appreciation for the important part of baseball stadiums and parks they play in a game."
Debbie, I'll ask Todd that question tomorrow, but the way I feel about it is if the games are moved to neutral sites, it's because of the coronavirus, and we're seeing some of the numbers move up for that. Just in talking with club executives, they do feel like there's a chance that there will be teams impacted as they go through this season, that there might be a team where there's a hot spot and suddenly that team, you know, moves from one state to another to try to find a spot. And, you know, it's just trying to make the best of a bad situation.
Last one up for today. My friend Kevin Seipold at Global Travel 62 writes in, "Hey, one of the places I lived during my travels in the UK for 7 years, So he watched a lot of cricket. Have you seen much cricket? What are your views? How would you compare it and contrast it to baseball?" You big cricket guy, Buster?
I am when I travel abroad too. Like last year we went to Australia. And during those 2 weeks, I found myself watching a lot of cricket. I was in England and went to Scotland for about a week. And my son and I, he's a crazy sports fan. We were trying to figure it out exactly. And even when I went to Japan, with my daughter 2 years ago, and we were in Tokyo and then we were in Hiroshima. We spent a lot of time watching cricket late at night. Yeah, I enjoy it. It's certainly a sport. Me as a baseball fan, I don't mind the slow pace. I bet you folks like my 15-year-old son probably struggle with the pace of it a little bit.
Interesting. Good stuff, everyone. Thanks for writing in. Hashtag BleacherTweets on Twitter. And please subscribe, rate, and review to this fine podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
That's it for today. My thanks to Kylie, Taylor, Dari, and Mel from way back in 2016. Have a great day. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on race is something we must fight every day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/PodCenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.